From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, historian and civil rights activist Roger Wilkins on the dilemma of black patriotism. His new book, Jefferson's Pillow, considers this paradox. The founding fathers created a nation conceived in liberty while owning slaves. Also, Brazilian actress Sonia Braga, the film that changed her life, The Kiss of the Spider Woman, has just been re-released and is returning to theaters. This week, she concluded her 3-episode guest appearance on Sex and the City. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD of duets featuring pianist Kenny Barron and violinist Regina Carter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Secretary of State Colin Powell and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon say they have agreed on a week-long test period for Palestinian compliance with a U.S.-brokered ceasefire. The announcement came as a Jewish settler was killed in a drive-by shooting in the West Bank today. NPR's Linda Gradstein has the story from Jerusalem.
Speaking at a joint news conference with Secretary Powell, Prime Minister Sharon said he wants to see a 7-day period of complete calm, followed by a 6-week cooling-off period. Sharon said only then will there be confidence-building measures, most significant for the Palestinians, a total freeze on Jewish settlement building. Earlier today, Secretary Powell said he favors a Palestinian proposal for international observers to monitor the ceasefire, a move that has always been opposed by Israel. At the news conference with Sharon, Powell seemed to backpedal, saying Israelis and Palestinians must agree on any observers in the region. Meanwhile, in Ramallah, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat called the American agreement for observers a very important step. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic is being transported to The Hague to face war crimes charges. He's the first former head of state to face such charges before a United Nations tribunal. Serbia handed over Milosevic to a tribunal official today. His attorneys said he was essentially kidnapped. Yugoslavia's current president, Vojislav Kostunica, said the transfer was illegal and unconstitutional. President Bush praised the move, saying it is evidence Yugoslavia wants to move away from a troubled past. A federal appeals court has thrown out an order that Microsoft be broken up. Microsoft now says it would like to settle the case. Deborah Brandt of member station KUOW in Seattle has more.
Overall, the appeals judges said they agreed the company behaved anti-competitively, but they also said comments by the trial judge gave the appearance he was biased against Microsoft and ordered that a new judge hear the next phase of the case. Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates says he's pleased the breakup order has been overturned. The Justice Department says it, too, is pleased with the ruling because it upheld the conclusion that Microsoft violated antitrust laws. With the breakup cloud removed, though, Gates says he would like to resume efforts to negotiate a settlement. The company came close to a settlement prior to trial, but not all of the attorneys general from the 19 plaintiff states agreed with the terms. The Justice Department says it's now reviewing the ruling and considering its options. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Brandt in Seattle.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 131 points to close at 10,566 in heavy trading of about 1.3 billion shares. Advancing issues led decliners by 3-2. The Nasdaq gained 50 points, closing at 2125, and the S&P 500 gained 15. This is NPR News. Two of the biggest gun control groups are merging to increase their influence and lobbying ability. The Million Mom March and the Brady Campaign and Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, formerly known as Handgun Control, will merge on the 1st of October. The announcement came on the same day the Bush administration proposed reducing the amount of time that the FBI can retain information on gun buyers after instant background checks. State and federal prosecutors in Buffalo, New York, are pleased with today's French court ruling recommending extradition of James Kopp to the United States. Kopp is accused in the 1998 shooting death of a Buffalo-area doctor who performed abortions. Mark Scott of member station WBFO has the details.
Prosecutors here say they are eagerly awaiting the return of Kopp, who eluded capture for more than 2 years. French police arrested him in March. Kopp faces both state and federal charges for allegedly shooting Dr. Barnett Slepian in his home. Kopp continues to proclaim his innocence. A 3-judge panel in France recommended extradition after receiving word from U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft that Kopp would not be subjected to the death penalty. France does not extradite suspects who face the death penalty in their own country. Kopp's attorneys have until next Wednesday to decide whether to appeal the extradition to France's highest court. The appeals process could take several months. For NPR News, I'm Mark Scott in Buffalo.
Voting 5-4, the Supreme Court today struck down tobacco advertising restrictions at retail stores and near schools and playgrounds. In a case from Massachusetts, the court said the state cannot enact tougher restrictions than those present in federal law. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, we celebrate Independence Day. Our founding fathers refused to be slaves to the English king, yet some of them owned slaves. My guest Roger Wilkins writes about the Founding Fathers from an African-American perspective in his new book Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He focuses on 4 Virginians, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, and George Mason. Wilkins writes, "They created a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that whites were and should be supreme. How is one to understand a nation whose dreams the slave owners despoiled even as they were creating it?" Wilkins is descended from enslaved Virginians. He's a professor of history at George Mason University, a longtime civil rights activist, and a former member of the Washington Post's editorial page staff. Let's start with Thomas Jefferson. As the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, he wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
That thought was not original to Jefferson. George Mason had written it much less elegantly in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which he had produced at the Virginia Convention just a few weeks before the Declaration was drafted and adopted in Philadelphia. So it was a thought abroad among the rebellious colonists, but Jefferson did it very elegantly. But none of these Virginians thought that they were writing about black people, about women, about Indians. As a matter of fact, from looking at their lives and looking at the origins of their rebellion, it is pretty clear that their aim, those words were aimed at the king and the aristocrats around him in his council. And when they said, "All men are created equal," they were saying, "We colonists are not the country bumpkins you're treating us as. We're not simply economic ciphers to be used for the great maw of the English economy. We are English gentlemen, just as you are. We are your equals. Don't treat us as inferiors." It was not their intention to drop a cloak of equality down over either their wives or of the black people they owned.
You quote one historian who said, "Ironically, it was slavery that made Jefferson free of his tedious, unremunerative law practice and enabled him to devote his energies to American freedom." What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. Their lives were made possible. Their greatness was made possible by slavery. The period from 1765, the Stamp Act crisis, to 1775, where the shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, John Adams called the real American Revolution. And that is the time when many of the colonists changed their minds about who they were. They'd all been born as Englishmen, and they loved England, and they loved the crown. And in that 10-year period, because of the contention, because of the overbearing policies of the king and his council, Because of the resistance efforts that the colonists mounted, because of the politics there did, the writing, the studying, the meeting, the organizing, the developing of institutions, and finally the development of a Continental Congress and a Continental Army, all of this took time to read, to study, to discuss. None of this would have been possible for them but for the wealth and the leisure that their slaves provided for them. So that that clearly was an accurate reflection. And I think it's kind of funny. Jefferson did start out as a real estate lawyer, and having practiced law myself, I think of real estate law being the least poetic of any profession I can think of. And yet Jefferson turned out to be the poet of the Revolution.
George Washington is one of the founding fathers you write about, and you say he didn't want blacks to join the army. Did he give reasons why? Or did he just assume everybody would agree with him?
Well, Washington was started out as kind of an ordinary Virginia aspirant to wealth. He was acquisitive. He wanted land. That was how you acquired wealth. In addition, you acquired wealth by marrying a rich widow, and he did that. And you made your land productive by using slaves. And he thought, and slave owners did not like the idea of having black people going around with guns, because they were always worried about slave rebellions. And so when he took command of the army at Cambridge in 1775, he found an army in which blacks were already fighting, because contrary to the way we teach history, blacks were present in every battle of the Revolution, virtually, and certainly they were at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. Well, that alarmed Washington, the Southerner, now up in Massachusetts, and he said he didn't want them in the army, but manpower needs prevailed. And so you see Washington in 1775 as a very conventional Southern slave owner and with deeply racist instincts.
Do you think that writing your new book, Jefferson's Pillow, has helped you resolve your feelings about being an African-American patriot?
Well, I started out as a patriot. That's the interesting thing. I grew up around civil rights giants. My Uncle Roy ran the NAACP for 20 years, and that was the NAACP was his life's work. Thurgood Marshall was like an extra uncle to me, and was, when I grew up, a boss, a friend, a colleague at the Justice Department, a mentor, and finally just a dear, dear friend. Martin King and I worked together and so forth. I was kind of the head of the federal government's, certainly part of the civil rights wing of the federal government in the 60s. So, and I realized that that the work we were doing was patriotic work, that it wasn't just the interests of black people that we were pursuing, but the interests of American justice, and we were expanding the meaning of the American Constitution in order to enlarge the structures of opportunity for everybody. So, and that's been the work of my life, and I have embraced it. But I felt, and I knew Thurgood was a thoroughgoing patriot, and I loved him dearly. And I never was easy, even though I knew I was a patriot. I was never easy with the word patriot until I began to resolve my feelings about these, about the Revolution, and also about slavery. And yeah, I have to tell you that having done this work, I embrace the Revolution. I even embrace these four slave-owning founders. Well, I embrace three of them. I find it a little hard to embrace Jefferson, but the other three I embraced pretty wholeheartedly.
Why is it that you feel you can embrace Washington, even though he didn't want blacks to join the army during the Revolutionary War, but you still have a hard time embracing Jefferson. They were both slave owners. Jefferson did write, "All men are created equal," even though he was a slave owner. Why are you having such a hard time with Jefferson and not Washington?
I think it's the difference in the moral moral content of their character, as Martin King would put it. Jefferson was obviously a brilliant man and had a great talent for writing, and his writing could soar when his passions were engaged. But over his lifetime, you don't get any sense of moral growth. You get sometimes moral anguish. He was able to talk about his belief that blacks would someday be free, and he was able to talk about the fruits of freedom for everybody, but he could also pen a terribly racist screed, as he did in Notes on the State of Virginia. And in the end, he just indulged himself, by leaving Washington's cabinet, and he indulged himself by buying all his French stuff, wine, furniture, and so forth, and got into debt, had to sell slaves. And his slaves were scattered to the winds because of his debts when he died. Washington, on the other hand, grew from a fellow who had only wealth and dandy aspirations as a young man to a man who shouldered willingly the heaviest burdens his society could lay on him. And he did it with a strength of character that is just astounding. And he did it decade after decade. And at the same time, he showed moral growth. He turned against slavery. First, he became a good slave owner. That is, he wouldn't sell slaves because he thought it was cruel, even though that meant that the slave population at Mount Vernon would grow and he would just go deeper and deeper into debt because Mount Vernon was no longer, with all of those slaves, a profitable proposition. And then at the end of his life, he 6 months before he died, he changed his will and he freed the slaves. But you freed the slaves at his death, after his death. In Washington, you see a man who brought less talent, but more strength of character and a deep moral sensibility. You feel in Washington's life a mulling of character issues that goes on and on and on and on. In Jefferson's life, you feel a deviousness, a craftiness, a self-regard. And in the end, though the revolution would not have had the frills and flourishes that it had because of Jefferson, you don't, at least in the period which I look at, and that is up to the death of Washington, you do not sense the kind of moral growth that you sensed in Washington.
My guest is Roger Wilkins. His new book is called Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roger Wilkins, and his new book is called Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. You were one of the leaders in America of the fight against apartheid in South Africa. Did some of the documents of the Founding Fathers, about who you're so ambivalent because they were slaveholders, did some of their documents kind of help you in that fight and help you find the right words and all of that?
The words of the Founding Fathers and their works have helped me my entire life. Thurgood taught me when I first worked for him as a law student a kind of reverence for the Constitution of the United States. And therefore, I got a early on a deep interest in James Madison. Throughout my lifetime, those words. But in the Free South Africa movement, I led demonstrations along with my colleagues in front of the South African embassy. At times, it was really tough. There were not many people there. It was cold or rainy, things like that. One day I was doing it, and I was feeling particularly silly, and people were driving home along Massachusetts Avenue and looking at us like we were a bunch of nuts, and I felt awkward and exposed, and I said to myself, what's wrong with you? You're leading these people. Why are you feeling this way? All you're doing is exercising your rights as a citizen under the Constitution of the United States, and you're an active citizen, and you're doing things on behalf of people who half a world away, who if they tried to do it in their capital for themselves, would at least end up in jail and perhaps would be killed. I had not studied Mason and the Declaration of Rights at that point, but it was Mason's spirit. It's the things that he wrote, the things that Madison wrote, the constitutional structure that those founders created that made me so sure as I marched up and down that street and did what I did that these were fundamental rights of an American citizen, and by God, I'm proud to be doing that. And those people who were passing in cars and comfort to their homes out in the Maryland suburbs were jerks if they didn't understand the glories of American citizenship. These things are my legacies as an American citizen that I owe to these founders, including the slave-owning founders. Maybe they didn't expect that some descendant of slaves would use these rights in that way, but they knew that they were letting loose in the world a ground for creative citizenship. That's what they had in mind. That's what I've tried to live, I have to be grateful for that that bequest. It's made my life. It's made the kind of life that I've lived possible.
You mentioned that you learned your reverence for the Constitution from Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was like an uncle to you. I think it's interesting that you learned your reverence from somebody who, you know, was such an important African-American figure in American history. In other words, you weren't learning your reverence from a white person who you would imagine wouldn't really understand the kind of ambivalence that you feel about the Founding Fathers. You learned it from Thurgood Marshall, who I'm sure could understand your ambivalence and probably felt a lot of it, too. Did you talk about this kind of thing with him?
I didn't talk about anything with Thurgood except what he wanted me to do when I was working with him, but
right.
I watched him, and I watched his life, and I listened to the way he would talk about the Constitution when he was shaping an argument or when he was arguing with somebody on the telephone or whatever we happened to be doing, and I understood that he loved this Constitution, and There were white men on the staff, Jack Greenberg and Bill Taylor, who loved the Constitution just as deeply. But Thurgood was the mentor and the boss of us all. Then the fact that he became a lifelong friend just happened to it embedded those values in me.
Do you find, as a professor, that you have a hard time convincing some of your African-American students that the Founding Fathers are worth caring about, or that some of the, you know, founding documents of the United States are worth caring about?
There's really an interesting connection. I teach in a way, the way Thurgood taught me to teach, and that is, when I teach black students or white students these things, I bring to the teaching the experiences of my life, like marching in front of the South African embassy and suddenly realizing that What I'm doing is a birthright from these founders, many of whom were slaveholders, and feeling warmed by that. And when I tell that story, black and white students get it. They really get it that these rights are real things, real values in their lives should they choose to become active citizens, and they came from these people. So, no, I don't find student resistance when I'm able to really put it across in vivid ways.
Do you know if any of your ancestors, any of your family, were slaves at the time of the Founding Fathers?
I don't. I know that my father's family was enslaved in Mississippi in the middle of the 19th century, as early as the middle of the 19th century, but beyond that, we can't go. My mother's family, I suspect, was enslaved much earlier because my great-grandfather, her grandfather, lived in Virginia in the early part of the 19th century, and he was light-skinned, free, and literate, which meant that there was probably quite a long history before that. And my guess would be that he was the third or fourth generation in the family. So yes, I suspect that that part of my family was here during the Revolution.
Roger Wilkins, thank you so much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed this very much, Terry. Thank you.
Roger Wilkins is the author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers, and The Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He's a professor of history at George Mason University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD of duets featuring pianist Kenny Barron and violinist Regina Carter. Also, Brazilian actress Sonia Braga, her breakthrough 1985 film, Kiss of the Spider Woman, is returning to theaters.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1985 movie Kiss of the Spider-Woman has been re-released and is returning to theaters. My guest is one of the film's stars, Sonia Braga. She's from Brazil, where she first became famous for her roles in popular TV soap operas. In the U.S., she first became known for her role in the 1978 Brazilian film Donna Flor and Her Two Husbands. She's currently playing Jennifer Lopez's mother in the film Angel Eyes, and this week she concluded her 3-episode guest shot on the HBO series Sex and the City, playing a lesbian who briefly becomes Samantha's lover. Let's start with Kiss of the Spider-Woman. It was the first independent film to receive Academy Award nominations for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. It's set in an unnamed Latin American country. William Hurt won an Oscar for his portrayal of an apolitical gay man imprisoned on morals charges, sharing a cell with a macho political prisoner played by Raul Julia. To keep them entertained, Hurt narrates the plots of old movies he's seen. In this scene, he's telling a love story from a movie that Raul Julia realizes is an old Nazi propaganda film. As Hurt describes the movie, we see it enacted, with Sonia Braga playing a glamorous singer, Lenny, in Nazi-occupied France, who is about to find out that her friend has fallen in love with a Nazi.
You mind if I tell my picture? After the show, Lenny changes into a satin evening gown that makes her look heavenly. Firm breasts, thin waist, smooth hips.
Is this propaganda or porno?
Just listen, you'll see.
Excuse me. Lenny.
What is it, Michelle?
Lenny. I'm a traitor. A traitor to France.
What do you mean?
I'm going to have a baby. But the father is a young lieutenant of the occupation army.
Is that so? My poor Michelle.
But he loves me and wants to get married as soon as he can get permission.
I really can't understand. How could you fall in love with an enemy of our France?
Sonia Braga, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you get the role in Kiss with a Spider-Woman?
Well, that's a very interesting. When I was finishing a movie with Marcello Mastroianni in Brazil called Gabriela, directed by Bruno Barreto, same as Donna Flor. And by the time I was 38 years old already, and since 17, all the characters that I played in my life, I was the lead. And, you know, I was thinking that time, I love to do a movie where I am only an extra. So I can hang with the crew, I can help them out, and I can learn more about the movies. When Hector Babenco invited me to play the character, it was very funny because when Hector come to me, he says, Sonia, I'm sorry to invite you, it's a little part, you know, I don't know even how to tell you. And I say, Hector, that's all that I want to do right now. And turn out to be what it is that we're talking about, you know.
One of the questions the movie asks is, do our movies, do our novels, do the stories that we tell each other have to reflect our political consciousness? Or is there value in just unabashed love stories, even if the love story comes from an old Nazi propaganda film? I'm wondering if that's a question you had to resolve for yourself, particularly earlier in your career when you were about 14, there was a right-wing military coup in Brazil, and that was followed by 20 years of military rule. So I'm wondering if that was a big issue in your life, whether the movies that you were in had to reflect your political consciousness or not.
That's what the way I think about arts and life. They are mixed together in politics. There is no one thing without another, and one doesn't survive another without another. When I was 14, I started a career in television, and when I was 17, the first role that I was given was by a woman called Eleni Guariba. And she just arrived in Brazil from Paris. She was Brazilian. And this is one of the people that disappeared, one of the people that was killed by the dictatorship, and we never even found her body anymore. And these are the people that inspired me in my life, in my career.
Were you in any movies or other productions when you were young that were considered subversive by the military dictatorship?
I am subversive. I still am. That, you know, I'm not subversive because I want to be polemic. I'm not, because I am. When I go to Brazil today, the next day, I'm in the front page of the newspapers because I get a broom and I'm going to sweep the streets because they're dirty, because people throw things in the streets, because that's the place, you know, the community should be. So it's always seems that I'm saying something that the majority, or especially the right wing, doesn't like too much, or conservative people.
Sonia Braga is my guest. In Sex and the City this season, you've played an artist who is a lesbian and has an affair with Samantha, the Kim Cattrall character. How did you get the part on Sex and the City?
Well, I'm a very good friend of Chris Noth, who took me for a premiere.
And he's one of the regulars on the show.
Exactly. He plays Mr. Big. And so we went to the premiere. There was a gay man in the show. And I came to the producers. And the truth, Terry, everything happens. Somebody's thinking, somebody's saying, I know when that happens. So I was saying something to the producer who was thinking about something. When I said that, I say, where is the gay woman here? You know, there's no, and then that was the first step for that to happen. And they wrote, and they offered to me, and of course, I'm in already.
Right.
So it was almost like the idea of this gap came from us, from observation.
You've played a lot of very sensual women in the movies. As you get a little older.
And some parties.
As you get a little older.
You know
older,
nothing.
Yes. As you get a little older, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how older women are treated sexually and sensually in scripts, you know, in movies and TV.
Oh, forget about it. we want to say, oh, of course. So, you know, I'm so happy that I did Sex in the City, you know, when I played this gay woman. Because I was watching the show the other day and I say, wow, this is so sexy. This is so great. And my Brazilian friends, directors, they were here. All the directors were here and they saw the Sex in the City. And they go, Sonia, it's so great to see you, you know. Like the Sonia, right? That Bruno Barret, the one that directed me, you know, being a sensual woman and everything. And I say, I know what you're saying because I'll play anything. You know, I'll play, when I say anything, it's like, I love to play the mother or, you know, there's so many women to play. I want to play all of them. But it is true, when you get older, you know, the tendency of sexuality not to be there. I'm going to tell you these two names just because they represent so much, okay? But I can't see a movie like Sonia Braga and Benicio del Toro and being a good, sensual, beautiful love story or adventure or something movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I see also a movie where I play Benicio del Toro's mother. You know, I'm not excluding reality from my talking here. You know, I can play both, but it's just a one side it's happening. And I believe that when I talk about the women, that they are getting older and that we're seeing movies about love, sexuality, about we're almost going to see Disney movies, you know, and we're grown up. We could talk about ourselves and being a fantastic thing, you know, a woman in bed with a man and having fun. Because do we have to say the old thing here that when they do a movie and the man is 50s, 60s, you know, they are dealing with the girls like 20s. Why cannot it be the other way around?
My guest is Sonia Braga. Here she is in a scene from this week's episode of Sex and the City, playing Maria, an artist who's a lesbian. She's spending the night at the condo of her new lover, Samantha, played by Kim Cattrall. One of Samantha's male lovers just invited himself over. In fact, several of the men in Samantha's life have turned up recently.
You let men come to your door like this in the middle of the night?
Let it go. It's all in the past.
No! It's not in the past. It's serving his drinks. It's on the answer machine. It's at your door in the middle of the night.
All right, this might come as a shock to you, but I used to have sex with men.
This man was here for nothing but sex.
Yes, which I used to enjoy and haven't had much of since I got into this relationship.
You call this a relationship?
Well, it's tedious and the sex is dwindling, so from what I've heard, yes.
If you have something to say to me.
I have nothing to say to you. I am fresh out of things to say to you. All we ever do is talk, talk, talk. The talking in our relationship has replaced the f***ing in our relationship. I don't want talk. I want passion. I want fireworks.
Oh, do you want fireworks? I show you fireworks. That's fireworks.
We'll talk more with Sonia Braga after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brazilian actress Sonia Braga. You grew up in Brazil, and your father
yes.
died when you were eight. What happened to him?
Oh, my father, he had business with land. He would buy and sell land. And he went to, this is the 50s in Brazil, right? And he was supposed to have a trip in center Brazil, a place called Mato Grosso. And he didn't go. And a friend of his took his place. And the airplane crashed. And one person survived from the crash. So he felt terribly guilt. And he wants to go and try to find the bodies of his friend, including and everything. And in that trip, he got very sick. He got malaria. And he came back home at 1 o'clock, and then he died at 8 p.m. And he was very young. He was 39, I think. And so he left like 7 children and my mom, and no 1 cent.
So what did your mother do to provide for you and your brothers and sisters?
My mom, then we could start talking about this great person. She started making dresses as a seamstress for the neighborhood girls, you know, for proms and things like that. And that's the way she provided. But right before that, she got a gig like telephone operator in a gas station in front of my house. So that's very little money. So everyone in my family had to work. Everyone. So even if I come back from school, I was 10, I had to come back and clean the whole house, wash the whole thing by hand, and press and cook and, you know. Here is not so much to say that, but for a kid in Brazil, it's a lot because, you know, all the middle class, that we have maids and things, you know. So it's a very important life that I had. That was the gift that life gave to me, you know, when life took away my father, gave me this very important gift.
You started acting professionally when you were 14, which is very young. How did you get into it that young?
Then comes another very important person in my life. That's my brother, who is gay. And he, from young age, he was away from the house. We didn't see him too much. He was watching movies. He was, And he was all over. So he met some people in theater, and he started being an actor. And from that, he started taking me. So I was 14, and that's my school. I never been to an acting school or anything, but I was in the best because I was watching Bergman's movies, Godard's movies, Bertolucci's, whatever was there, Fellini. I was there to watch. And we have a group of people that would discuss these movies. So at the age 14, I have to analyze what was that Bergman wants. So at young age. So the directors that worked with him invite me to play little parts, and I start playing little parts, and then other friends. By the time in Brazil, in São Paulo, I grew up in São Paulo, not in Rio, the theater and movies community, imagine, was like about probably 100 people together. So everybody knew everybody and, you know, in each other. So I had the privilege to know everything through friends in Brazil.
Does your brother still act?
No, he became a painter. He's an artist.
You got your start acting in soap operas in Brazil. What were some of the storylines or some of the characters that you played? I'm hoping this will help give us a sense of what the soap operas were like.
Well, soap operas in Brazil, for you to have an idea, there was a Brazilian actress that she got Best Actress in Television in China. So they
right.
showed the soap operas. Yes, that's far away. And so the soap operas, usually they're very good ones. The writers are incredible. We have these two phenomena in Brazil, I believe to be phenomena. It's a soap opera. The best Brazilian writers, they write for soap operas. And the best poets, they are musicians. So we have the two forms of popular art to the reach of everybody, which is very good. And usually the theme can be anything, can be start with a love story, as the structure of soap opera is. But usually you can see a social background. Usually you have that, the differences in society, you know, and a very good point of view of that. Very, very good people write soap operas in Brazil. To give an example, Jorge Amado, probably the Hispanics would call him Jorge Amado, and he's the best, one of the best writers in Brazil. And so his book, Gabriela, was adapted for a Brazilian soap opera, and with very important political and social themes happening northeastern Brazil in the 30s. Always you're going to see something good on TV.
Some of the soap operas you were in Brazil played around the world. Have you gone to other countries where people recognize you from the soap operas?
Oh, yeah. I went after they showed Gabriela in Portugal. In Portugal, they have to put like televisions all over in theater, restaurants, and everywhere because the country would stop to see the soap opera. And I went to visit, and they put him in the top of the car. You don't expect that to happen to you, an actor. You expect to happen with some singer, rock singer, that a woman fainted when she saw me. The other one gave me her son or baby to be blessed because I was in the top of the car like I was a president or a pope or something. It was amazing. I had a bodyguard. So what they did was very incredible to me. They would tell the next town that we were going to be arriving, right? So they closed the stores and everything. They closed the town and everybody would come out like a parade to see Gabriela. I wouldn't say myself. I would say this character. And, you know, to see this character loved, it was really important to me.
Well, Sonia Braga, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
So, I thank you so much.
Sonia Braga, her 1985 film Kiss of the Spider-Woman has been re-released. It opens in New York tomorrow and will open in more cities over the next few weeks. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD featuring pianist Kenny Barron and violinist Regina Carter. This is Fresh Air. Veteran jazz pianist Kenny Barron usually works in bands with bass and drums, but he also recorded informal duets with Stan Getz and others. Violinist Regina Carter's records lean toward mainstream or commercial jazz, but she also spent 6 years playing new music in the String Trio of New York. Kenny Barron and Regina Carter have now recorded as a duo. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's a good match.
No setting is more congenial to close improvising than the duo. Each player has only one person to listen to, with no distractions, and partners can read each other quickly enough to deal with unsignaled turns and side trips. At its best, the Kenny Barron Regina Carter CD Free Fall has just that looseness and spontaneity. They largely sidestep the echoes of European classical music you might expect with piano and violin. On Johnny Hodges' 1941 romp, Squatty Rue, they're more interested in classic jazz sounds, a rolling barrel house bass from the piano, and the bluesy grease of swing-era fiddler Stuff Smith. Pianist Kenny Barron is first among equals here. He's got about 3 decades more experience than Regina Carter and is never at a loss for ideas, where she runs on fumes once in a while. This meeting was Barron's idea. He's very good at drawing her out, and he revels in the extra demands on himself without bass or drums for support. But violin doesn't vanish when the spotlight's on piano. Carter often chimes in with her own harmony parts, staying in the picture and keeping up the dialogue. At 70 minutes, the CD Free Fall could stand some pruning. They could have lost a couple of sappier ballads, including Fragile by Sting. but they make amends. The album's centerpiece and title track is its riskiest venture, an 8-minute free improvisation. It works because they listen to each other as closely as on the written pieces. Major label jazz records, this one's on Verve, tend to be overproduced nowadays, especially when heavily promoted musicians like Regina Carter are involved. So it's surprising Free Fall is as fluid and gimmick-free as it is. The lack of a high concept, like the lack of a conventional rhythm section, frees Carter and Kenny Barron to go where they will. They make the most of what's missing.
Kevin Whitehead is based in Chicago. He reviewed Free Fall, featuring Kenny Barron and Regina Carter. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail is being re-released and is returning to theaters. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews from our archive with John Cleese, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, and the late Graham Chapman. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.